This is the 24th of April, 1994, and my name is Dennis Stevens, and I'm cutting this tape for Anthony Phillips, and the subject matter of the tape, as requested by Anthony, is L. Ron Hubbard, the man that I knew. My personal contact with Ron Hubbard stretched from a period from September 1952 through to 1955, late 1955, early 1956 actually. Then there was a break when we went to Australia. There was no personal contact then for a period until 1962, when I did the St. Hill briefing course. And again, there was a personal contact with Ron Hubbard while I was on the St. Hill briefing course during the year 1962. There was, of course, a comm line to Ron that continued on and off over the years. Even when I was in Sydney, I had a comm line working with the org, working in the field. I always did have a comm line to Ron. I could always write to him and get a reply from him, a personal reply from him at any time. And, of course, while I was in the org, I had a direct comm line to the old man as well. I will refer to him as the old man because I always knew him as the old man. It's only in later years that I've stopped calling him the old man and started to call him Ron Hubbard. But affectionately, like many staff members, ex-staff members, I know Ron as the old man. There was no personal or written comm with Ron after 1965. So that gives you some idea of the period involved. The most intimate contact with Ron Hubbard was in the period from 1952 to late 1955, and that is the period that Anthony has asked me to concentrate on, because evidently there is some scarcity of people around who have commented on their personal contact with Ron during this period. Apparently, all the articles and so forth that have appeared on contact with Ron have been later than 1955. Well, I hope to be able to remedy that scarcity. It's necessary for me to give a brief resume of my Scientology history to understand how I did actually get into contact with him. My first contact with Dianetics was through the Astounding Science Fiction magazine article. I had a subscription to the Astounding Science Fiction magazine in 1950. And as soon as that article appeared in the magazine in May 1950, I wrote off for the book Dianetics, the Modern Science of Mental Health. And it was air freighted over, and I started using it, started co-auditing in September 1950, and subsequently found out that my co-auditor and I were we were the second co-auditing team to start up in Britain. So I go a long way back. I go a long way back in England, Dianetics and Scientology in England. I subsequently joined the Wishlow Northwest London Dianetic Group, run by George Wishlow, and I became the group secretary, and continued on as a group auditor and group secretary through 1950, and all through 1951, and all the way through 1952, until the first contact with Ron Hubbard appears in September 1952. And just to come up to that, give you the reality of what was occurring at that time, the news came through that Ron Hubbard would be coming to London in September 1952. And George Wishlow, the head of the group, he got that word over from America. And prior to that, the only Dianeticist or Scientologist we'd seen from America was Jack Horner. He was the only other one, the only trained one. We'd had a few that had come over and spoken, but they had no, they didn't, you know, they'd only, they were no more than, their use of the subject was no more than ours. They were book auditors and so on. And so the only other one we'd ever spoken to who'd been trained and done an HDA course and a Bachelor of Scientology course was Jack Horner. He arrived in England in 1950, first arrived in England in 1951 and gave a congress, which I attended. And but anyway, the big news, that was the big news, August 1952. I'd been getting very excellent results as a pre-clear from Dianetics. And I was mightily impressed with the subject, and I didn't know it at the time, but I was a very easy running pre-clear. Any auditor would have given his back teeth to have a pre-clear like me. I always was an easy running pre-clear. I didn't know it, of course, but it was only after many years of auditing tough cases that I realised that the vast majority of humanity are much more difficult to audit than I am. Anyway, to move now into September 1950, late August 1952 is when he actually appeared. Late August, early September. It might have been late August or early September when he actually appeared at the the Wishlow Dianetic Group. This material, by the way, of this period is also mentioned in the memoirs of Dennis and Anne Stevens, which is a series of 4.5 hours of the Scientology memoirs of Dennis and Anne Stevens, which is in the possession of Greg Pickering. He has the copies and tapes of that. So I'm duplicating here, and I won't duplicate any more than I have to, I can assure you. But my first contact with Ron Hubbard was when he strolled into, there was a knock at the door. Everyone was there. We normally at our group meetings, we had about 15 members, 15 people would turn up, that regulars and visitors, 15 or 20. Well, that night we must have had about 60 people there in that big room of George Wishlow's. And they were almost literally hanging from the chandeliers. The word that he was in London, and his first port of call on that Sunday evening, he was going to devote the whole evening to being with us at the Wishlow Dianetic Group, was enough to, George had been burning the telephone, and he got all and sundry there. Everyone who could conceivably get there was there that Sunday evening. There's a lot of people from the group, other London groups, who couldn't get there because they too were holding their group meetings on that Sunday. So they couldn't be there, they had to be at their own groups. But other than that, we had about 60 people there, and the meeting progressed. And suddenly there was a knock at the door, and George dashed out and opened the front door, and in strode this. He seemed an enormous, my first impression of Ron, although I'd seen photographs of him, my first impression was his size, was his physical size. He seemed a very, very large person. It was only that when I got to know him better and realised that this was a part of the mock-up that he put over his size, that he wasn't actually anywhere near as big physically as you thought he was. He was near 6 foot, just maybe a shade under 6 foot in height, and probably weighed about, 180 pounds, something like that. And he got a lot heavier than that in the later years, but at that time, he wasn't all that heavy at that time, but he seemed enormously large. And he walked in the room and filled the room immediately. That was impression, was his presence. And he walked into the room. Everything stopped, and he was immediately the centre of attention. And so that was my first impression of the man, was his presence, was his physical presence, his startling physical presence, the size of him physically, and his startling psychological presence, the size of him psychologically. One definitely knew that there was somebody there. He was the sort of person that if he was in the room behind you, you'd know he was behind you, and you would turn round and not be surprised to find the one standing there. That happened to me on many occasions with Ron Hubbard in those early days in the 50s, that Ron would, in the org and so forth, when he was around in the org, I'd be talking to someone in the room and the door would be open, and suddenly I'd be aware that Ron was in the room. I'd know he was there, and I'd turn around, and there he walked in and was standing, waiting. He wanted to speak to me about something, and he was standing patiently waiting for me to finish a conversation. But I knew he was behind me. I could sense his presence. He was that sort of person. He had an enormous psychological presence, Ron Hubbard did. Anyway, that particular group meeting was a milestone in my life, because as it turned out, my life was never the same again after that group meeting. Ron spoke about Scientology, gave us a talk, and he talked, I suppose, for about three quarters of an hour about Scientology, then answered some questions, and then said he's going to give a demonstration, and he wanted a volunteer to come up. And strangely, I was mad to get my hand up. I thought, well, as I was the group's guinea pig, if anyone was going to give a demonstration session, anyone wanted to demonstrate an auditing technique, well, I was always the guinea pig, because I had a virtually indestructible case. I was the easiest running pre-clear, and everyone in the group knew it. Some of the group members could be damaged psychologically by group demonstrations, but they knew that I was indestructible, that they could leave me in an engram, and I'd find my way out of it, and no harm would come out of it. I didn't understand it at the time, but it was just a state that I'm a very easy running, I've always been an easy running pre-clear, and it was almost impossible to harm me psychologically with the techniques. So I thought, well, I won't put my hand up, because I'll give some of the other members here might like a go at the demonstration. But I looked around, there was no hands going up. Ron was he'd announced that he wanted to give an auditing demonstration of exteriorization. And maybe that's what put everyone off. They were a bit scared of it. Not even George Wishlow got his hand up. And George was no person to not come forward when he was interested in something. But in that instant, I thought, if nobody else wants the opportunity, it might never happen again. So my hand shot up, and he ran up and smiled at me and called me over to the stand, and my life changed. He did a technique of giving commands to my foot and receiving commands back and turning a few energy masses white and so on. And the next thing, I told him that I was exteriorized, and he said, very good. And he moved me around the room, and the tremendous perception there I was struck with there. It was the weird sensation of sitting there above 60 people, and I could see them all clearly below me. I was up near the ceiling where Ron had moved me, and there was Ron addressing my body, and I could see my body there, I could see Ron there. I could see the whole thing much, much clearer than I could through my eyes. And there it was all happening, and everyone was watching the demonstration, and I was up on the ceiling. it was an incredible experience. And he moved me around and moved me out into the road, and I found I could move through the wall, and I could see through the wall, all sorts of things I could do. Then he moved me around and got me comfortable and said, do you want to come back into your body or stay outside? I said, no, thank you very much, I'm quite happy out here. So he said, right, well, he got me to open my eyes again, and ended the demonstration. And by that time, it was getting up to 10 o'clock, and people had buses and trains to catch. It being a Sunday, the transport didn't run very late in London at that time. And very quickly, the group meeting broke up, and I had to dash off and get a last bus. And getting off the bus and walking the mile and a half, I'd missed the last bus connected up to my home. I had to walk a mile and a half along a deserted road to get to my house. And the incredible feeling of walking along there, being exterior from my body, and my body was in front of me. And this weird sensation of walking along and the body in front of me shadowing the streetlights. In other words, as I walked along, suddenly a streetlight would appear in my visual field on the right-hand side as it appeared around the side of my head, where it had been in shadow by my head. It startled me for a moment, but I didn't realise what was going on. I moved further back behind my body. And the exteriorization was almost complete. It was an almost the type of exteriorization you would get between lives, as I later discovered. The exteriorization was incredibly complete. And I just walked for a whole mile and a half down that road, sitting about full 10, 15 foot behind my body, and just moving down the road with my body there and looking at the houses as I was walking along, and my body was sort of just walking along the road there. It was the most incredible experience. And then I moved, got into my house and went to bed, and again went up into the loft, nosed around on the roof, and ended up sitting out at about midnight, sitting out on the lamppost in the road, watching the moths fly around the lamppost. And there I went to sleep. When I woke up in the morning, I'd moved back into my body again. But it changed my life. I then knew that Scientology was absolutely right. And I knew that when Ron spoke of exteriorization, talked about a thetan, that he was right. I had so much tremendous personal certainty on it. There was not a shred of doubt in my mind. And when he said then that he had said at the group meeting that he was going to run a professional course, well, that was where I wanted to be. That I knew that what he was talking about was the goods. And the one thing I wanted to be was a professional Scientologist, because this was the future. This was the way it was. This enormous exteriorization ability, I was what they used to call at the time a theta clear, stayed with me. It lessened slowly, but it stayed with me for months. It had an interesting validation. I was already courting my future wife at the time, and yes, we were. I knew my future wife, and later on, I'm just kidding, unsnarling the time track. Yes, I was courting her at the time, and we used to. At one point, I was in London. There, I had a flat in London, and she was down in Battersea, and we couldn't be together that evening. We were very much in love, and I used to go and visit her as a thetan late at night, and she always knew I was there. I could come in, look around the room, and there she would be laying on the bed reading. I'd go over and touch her forehead, and she'd look up. I could see her look up, and she would look up. And she knew I was there. The following day, I'd phone her or see her, and she'd say, "You were over last night." I'd say, "Yes, come over and visit you." And she couldn't do it, of course. She hadn't got the ability, but she always knew when I was there. She could sense my presence very, very strongly. So it wasn't all in my mind. There was a present time, there was another person who could validate the exteriorization ability that I had, and the ability to actually be felt, that my presence could actually be felt by another person in the universe, in the present time universe. So it wasn't all imagination. It had validation there. I have been audited by Ron Hubbard more than once. Always in demonstration sessions, but I can say without a shadow of a doubt that he was the best auditor that ever audited me. I was never audited by a better auditor than Ron. Ron was the smoothest, and he was the greatest, and I've been audited by some very fine auditors, including Jack Horner, who I rate only just slightly below Ron Hubbard as an auditor. Unfortunately, they're both dead now. But Ron was the greatest as an auditor. He was the greatest auditor. He was the only auditor I ever met, I ever knew, who never really needed an e-meter. Ron could, when you were in session with Ron as a pre-clear, something would happen in session, some mental scene would occur, and Ron would come in and say, "What's happening?" He knew it. He'd spot it straight away. He didn't need them. He used to use a meter, but he didn't really need one. He knew the slightest change in the session he was on to. That is the mark of the truly great auditor. And Ron had that ability. He was the only auditor I ever knew who had that ability. He could determine the slightest of changes in the pre-clear by direct perception. And he could do it time and time again. And it gave you an enormous feeling of confidence when you were being audited by Ron Hubbard. You felt that he was right there with you, as indeed he was. He was right there with you, holding your hand as the pre-clear in the session. You felt that there was somebody else there holding your hand. And I got that feeling, always got that feeling, whenever Ron audited me. And I never got it with any other auditor. Slightly with Jack Horner, but it was only very, very faint. With Ron, it was strong. And with other auditors, never. I've never experienced it with other auditors at all. So he stood head and shoulders, Ron did, as an auditor. He was head and shoulders above any other auditor I'd ever met. Well, almost needless to say, when you experience something like that from a man, when he audits you, he invented the subject. He discovered the subject, he formulated the subject, and he tries it on you, and it works exactly as he said, and you get validation that it's not all imagination, that it's actually real, and it's working exactly the way he said it. You're inclined to grant this man certain godlike qualities. And when you realise his personality, he had this enormous presence that I've already mentioned. That when he walked into a room, he was there. There was a person there. So he had a physical presence and a psychological presence. And on easy running pre-clears, Ron could make his subject, and I wasn't easy running pre-clear, Ron could make his subject work exactly the way he said it worked. He might not be able to do it on difficult running pre-clears, but he could sure as hell make it work on easy running pre-clears. And the effect on the subject, the effect on me, was to grant him enormous beingness as a person, to grant him almost godlike qualities. And it was inevitable that it would happen, and it did happen. And I was awestruck by the old man. I wonder what sort of a person he was, whether he was a god, a demigod, or what. That was in September 1950. Towards the end, middle of September 1950, I started the HPA course in London. That course was personally taught by Ron Hubbard, and there was about 15 of us on the course. And there was two or three auditing demonstrations. He used to give regular auditing demonstrations, and I think about two or three times I was the subject on the course. He quickly realised, Ron did, that I was a very easy running PC, and when he quickly wanted to demonstrate something, he just lifted up and said, "Dennis, can I just go over?" And he'd run it on me and demonstrate the point he wanted to make. He too, like the group members found, he too was using the advantages of a very, very easy running pre-clear. And a person who, because of the state of case, could be got to do things rather easily, and there will be no ill effects and so forth. So I had two or three auditing demonstrations from Ron during the HPA course. And each one of them, there was that same presence, that same feeling of the master auditor there, when he was auditing me. It's interestingly enough that I spoke to many other people about Ron as an auditor, and many people have been audited by Ron in demonstrations, but not everyone. Many of them did agree that he was a tremendous auditor. But others, I did hear people say that they didn't think much of, they didn't feel that he'd done anything for them at all. They didn't care for his style of auditing, which I thought was most peculiar. But each and every one of these was a tough case. Quite interesting, isn't it? It was a subjective. He obviously, the person was a tough case. The auditing demonstration had not produced any positive result, and the person wasn't particularly impressed. And so it reflected on the pre-clear's feelings about the auditor. I did actually meet more than one person in London at that time who'd been audited by Ron in auditing demonstrations, who didn't think he was a particularly good auditor. After the training course, after the course was finished, it goes through, it was an 8-week course, full-time course. We got through to November 1952, and by that time, Ron had got the HASI organised in London, and I went on staff immediately. I was the first director of processing on staff. He wanted me on post right away. I'd completed all my course requirements, sent in my case histories, got my HPA and my HGA certificate. I graduated as close to his honours as it was possible to get, and Ron wanted me. He came straight after me and wanted me as a DP in HASI London. So I was London's first director of processing. And by that time, Anne and I were together. She was my future wife, Anne Walker. And she was the first association secretary of London, Anne was. And from that point onwards, once Mary Sue was pregnant at the time with their first child, and once she got over the pregnancy, given birth, and Mary Sue was now around and available again and started to get back into social life again. Quite often, Ron and Mary Sue would invite Anne and I out to dinner in the evening and socially. And we used to get on quite well socially there. But I always got along better with Ron than I did with Mary Sue, and so did Anne. Mary Sue wasn't the easiest of people to get along with. At least not to a person like me, she wasn't. But I found Ron a very easy person to socially to get along with. As I got to know Ron better, and this only because we were meeting socially and in restaurants and so forth and nightclubs, as I got to know him better, I realised things about him which I hadn't noticed at the beginning. And there was things about Ron, this was the way he would treat everyone. I don't know whether other people noticed this, because I don't think I ever mentioned it to anyone, except to Anne, and she agreed with me, was that Ron didn't experience people. When somebody was talking to Ron, he didn't experience them. He confronted them. Now, there is a difference. If somebody's talking to me, I experience them. I don't confront them. Now, I better possibly explain that. It's a technical thing. To confront means to, literally, to confront means to front with. Now, Ron, in all his life, only fronted with things. He confronted. In fact, he developed a training drill called confronting. He called it confronting. And I think Ron only ever knew how to confront people. He always fronted them with something. He never experienced them. I can confront people. I can put things, I can front with things, and I can experience. When you're experiencing, you're not fronting with anything. You're knowing them. You're experiencing them. And it's quite different from confronting. But Ron evidently didn't deduce that. Ron, in all his personal dealings with people, he always confronted them. He used to confront them when he was talking to them, and he would confront them when he was listening to them. Whatever was happening, Ron always was confronting. And that was the presence. It was a mock-up, a glowing mock-up, you might say, that he used to put there to confront people with. And that's what you used to sense when he walked into the room. It was to confront. It was the thing he was fronting with. I remember when I first spoke to Anne about this, she almost had a line charge and had a tremendous cognition. She spotted it, but she didn't quite grasp it, didn't quite understand it. She said, yes, it's exactly right, isn't it? That's exactly what he does. He's a confronter. He puts, there's something there, he's putting there for you to look at. Then that's what you see. He doesn't experience you. He confronts you. And it's so true about Ron Hubbard. If you knew that about Ron, You knew his innermost part of the man's personality, that he never experienced, he always confronted. And that maybe it was a weakness in his personality. I don't think Ron ever really experienced anything. He sure as hell confronted. He confronted one hell of a lot. But I don't think he ever really experienced anything. I don't think he was capable of it. But he was one hell of a confronter. Another thing about Ron that I think many people realise this who'd spoken to him, been with him socially, was that he was a conversation hogger. He was a, you know, if you were at a dinner party, sitting around a table, then the whole evening revolved around you, everyone sitting listening to Ron. It's not that he actually stopped other people from talking, but they just, anything other people said was just ammunition for Ron to come up with something which was usually very, very interesting and very, very worth hearing. In other words, he was a tremendous conversationist, a first-class raconteur, and whatever you had to say paled into insignificance compared to what he had to say. So everyone would sit with rapt attention to listen to Ron and think that was quite the most natural thing in the world, to listen to Ron talking. I didn't know at the time we used to talk there socially, and he used to talk about his early auditing experiences in the USA with his various auditors. He never had much success with auditors auditing him. The two reasons for this was, of course, that he was a very fast moving preclear, very quickly moving preclear, and would move rapidly up and down his time track, and he could usually move much, much faster than the auditor could follow. And the other reason for it was that this was the subject of confronting. That I don't think Ron ever did really experience his engrams in Dianetics. I think he confronted them. And he used to go into a sort of a pitched battle with his engrams. He used to confront them. It was a part of his personality, you see. Just like socially he would confront. I think he used to confront on his track too. And it used to get him into some difficulty in the session with the auditor. And because there he was confronting his engrams. And he shouldn't have been confronting them. The preclear is supposed to experience his engrams. He's supposed to examine them. That means to experience them, to know them. He's not supposed to be in there confronting them with anything. He's supposed to be simply, the auditor might want to do a bit of confronting, but the preclear is supposed to be experiencing his engram bank, not confronting it. It's a fine technical point, but I can assure you that is the way it is, that you don't get very far as a preclear in Dianetics or in Scientology if you set out to confront your bank. Ron used to talk about confronting your bank, but it was a mistake. It was the only thing he ever knew how to do. He didn't know how to experience because he was a confronter. The only way he knew how to handle life was to put something, was to front it with something, put some energy mass there and use that energy mass to front life with while he sat in the background and charged up this energy mass there. And that was the way Ron was as a man. Now, as I said, if you know that about him, you understand that about him, you understand, really do, you have really got him. You really understand, because all of his behaviour then starts to make tremendous sense, as it did to me, to Anne and I, as we got to know him better. It all began to fall into place. We started to examine the man and understand the man in terms of his behaviour. And in terms of our increasing knowledge of Dianetics and Scientology. During the period of the 1950s there, when I knew Ron, he was not the subject of finances, which became quite obsessive with him in his later part of his life, didn't really concern him at all. He was only concerned with tech. And he certainly, the organisations and so forth, in 1953, 1952, when it started in London, right through to about 1956, when the unit system was brought in. Well, during that period, from 52 to 56, the salaries and the payments and so forth in the Hazy London were well above average for commerce and business. I was an executive during that period, and my pay was way up, and an ordinary staff auditor coming straight off course could earn more money as a staff auditor than they could working in an office or working in a factory. The average wage at that time was about £8 a week, I suppose. Well, now about less than that, about £7. Well, you could earn £10 a week as a staff auditor in Hazy London any old time for a week of staff auditing. You could earn £10. That was before the unit system came in. So Ron was not a mean payer. He was a very generous payer. He was an extremely generous person too during this period when I knew him. Extremely generous person of his time. If a person was in trouble, I've known that man to stay on the phone for an hour and a half of the night time to get some pre-clear out of difficulties. Who was in difficulties, and and the auditor would phone Ron, and Ron took over the session, and he was on the phone for an hour and a half getting that person out of difficulties, that pre-clear out of difficulties. In other words, the auditor had got the bloody pre-clear into a mess and got phoned up Ron in a panic at midnight, so help me. And poor old Ron has to stay up till up after an hour and a half to patch up this crummy bit of bloody auditing that this crummy auditor had done. He shouldn't have been auditing this type of pre-clear at that time of night, you know. But nevertheless, Ron would give, not think anything of it, spend an hour and a half on the phone, give of his time there, get the pre-clear squared around there. He was that sort of man. He was a very, very generous man and very, very generous financially to his staff. We were all treated very well, and our hours of work and so forth were quite congenial. There was no question of exploitation. There was a good team spirit and good pay, and we were quite a good team. While Ron was present. Now, I say while Ron was present advisedly, because while Ron quite often during that period from 52 to 55, early 56, when we were on staff and so forth, in close contact with Ron, that Ron will be out, he'd be away in America, or he'd be on holiday somewhere, he'd be out of London, he simply wouldn't be there. And we would be on a comm line of air letters to the old man. It was long before the days of telexes and so forth. And all the communications were by mail. And it was then we began to realise that the weakness of the man's personality. Ron was at his best when the person he was dealing with was in front of him. When the person was distant from him that he was dealing with, he started to get to his worst. Ron was hardly the same person on a comm line, on a distant comm line, than he was when he was with you in the same room. He was in good control of the situation when he could perceive it, and so forth, in present time. It was something he could put his paws on, he could handle it, and he could do it. And he was a darn near genius at doing it. But put him at a distance, and he was at his weakest. Now, what exactly was his weakest? What was that exactly that was his weakness at a distance? Well, what exactly was this weakness that Ron had when he was trying to handle a thing at a distance? It was a question of selecting importances generally, but in particular was on people around him that he trusted. Ron had a very, very poor ability to select the trustworthy from the untrustworthy. This used to occur when it first occurred, when I first became aware of it, I didn't hardly believe it. And I checked with Anne, and she'd spotted it too, but she could hardly believe it too. That in such a great man, there was this almost a blankness in his personality. That he couldn't evaluate trust in other people. He couldn't evaluate it. And he was almost a sucker for bad news. And the 1.1 tone level communication. So at a distance, what would happen was he would go off to America, say, and somebody in London outside of the org would write to him and say how bad things were in Hazy London while he was away, and he would believe them. Now, you can say that he believed them because he wanted to believe them. Well, maybe that's true. Maybe it was a part of his growing paranoia, which I'll talk about later. Maybe it was because he wanted to believe that things were bad over there. while he was away. But nevertheless, all the troubles that came about during that period came about when Ron was away. The most incredible thing happened during that period from late 1952 through to 1955 on the organizational lines of Scientology. And all these incredible things happened while Ron was away and receiving N Theta from the lunatic fringe and believing it. And not making any real attempt to check the validity of these lies, and they were lies. Instead of that, assuming they were true and making staff changes and so forth in his org in London, and putting people into the org who had no place to be in the org, that they were simply untrustworthy people. They were technically unqualified, and they were untrustworthy people. Or they were just plain incompetent. But Ron could never see this at a distance. If he spoke to them up close and talked to them, questioned them carefully personally, he'd spot it. He wouldn't be fooled. But at a distance, they could fool him every time with a letter. I mean, we had a woman was put in charge of HASI, was put in charge of HASI London for a period. There, at 16, he was in charge of 163 Holland Park Avenue. There was the two orgs. There was the one org at 163, and there was the clinic and the training department up at Palace Gardens Terrace. And she came in as a secretary and worked her way up by writing letters to Ron while he was away, telling him how bad things were at Palace Gardens Terrace. And the next thing he knew, he put her in charge of the whole operation. And this woman was the wife of a communist. Ron hated communists. One thing about Ron Hubbard, politically, Ron was a little bit to the right of Genghis Khan, you know. But he didn't know that this woman's husband was a communist. We did. Anyway, she was put in charge. She was a communist as well. And, I mean, if you spoke to this woman for 5 minutes, you would see that this person was untrustworthy. I mean, I spotted this as soon as I spoke to her. I said, oh, this person's not trustworthy. She's not a criminal or anything, but I wouldn't, you know, one of these people, the more she spoke of her, the more she spoke of her honesty, the faster we counted our spoons, if you remember the quotation. Anyway, after a while, Ron comes back from overseas and gets into HASI London, goes down and says, I won't give the person's name, but she goes down there and says, could you release a few hundred pounds? I'm a bit short of money. Released a few hundred pounds from the funds. And she said, sorry, Ron. She says, all the funds are locked up under my signature. I don't feel like giving you any of the money. And so help me, while he was away, she'd managed to steal a HASI. She stole HASI London from him. That she had she was the sole signature on the bank account at HASI London, and he'd signed it. Somewhere he'd signed it. He'd signed away HASI London to her. I don't know how she managed it. I don't think he ever knew how she managed it. Maybe she sent him something and he'd signed it, because when he left HASI London, he had the signature, and him and Mary Sue had the signature on the account. They were the only ones who had the signature on the main account. When he came back, he hadn't got it. He checked with the bank, and it was true. His signature had been removed from the account. This woman's signature was on the account. And it cost him $5,000 to buy back HASI London. So that, when you look at the old Joburg security check, you'll see that little question that appears there, have you ever stolen a HASI? And that's how it got on the security check. Ron remembered it. He has had HASI stolen from him. But it was his own fault, really, for putting in charge of it a person who's just an untrustworthy person. She, of course, went off. She got £5,000 out of it. He bought her back, and she released the account back to him. There's nothing he could do about it. He couldn't sue her or do anything. Everything she'd done was perfectly legal. As far as the bank was concerned, the man had turned over the signature of the account to this woman. And they got written evidence to prove it. So there was nothing he could do about it except power out to get his organisation back. A few months after that happened, one day, a guy strolls in one Monday morning, another guy strolls in and announces he's got a letter in his pocket from the old man in the USA saying he's been put in charge of Hazy London. And this guy was a book auditor, middle-aged chap, didn't look anything special, and bit of a merchant of fear he was, actually. And we found out later he'd never had a case going in his auditing. And here he was put in charge of everything. And it had all been done by letter over the Atlantic. He'd written to Ron and said things about how bad they were in Hazy London, and Ron had put him in charge. Apparently just like that, as far as I know. Well, there was the man's weakness, you see. That at a distance, he could be fooled by in theta. When he was present, you couldn't do it to Ron. He would spot these characters like anyone else would, you know. He'd spot the in theta merchants. But at a distance, they could fool him. They could fool him by letter. But more importantly was that the fact of that he would believe these in theta merchants over his own true and trusted staff that he knew and had spoken to and knew were trustworthy. That he would believe them. He would believe the entheta merchant. This was the oddity in the man's. It could only be a quirk in his personality, because it didn't make any sense. It didn't make any sense. I mean, even if he believed the entheta, a rational man would write to his true and trusted staff with a copy of the letter he'd received and say, "Comments, please." You know, that's what normally what a managing director would do. "Please explain this. I want a full report on this," and then act accordingly. But no, Ron wouldn't do that. He'd receive the entheta, then act on the entheta, make no inquiry, and start firing people right, left and centre in his organisation on the basis of the entheta. So it was a weakness in his personality. It was only later, much later, that we began to understand why he did this, that it was a part of the... This didn't become apparent until up towards 1960 there. Became very obvious there that there was a definite paranoid streak in Ron Hubbard's personality, a definite paranoid streak. In the early 1950s, the paranoia was very, very mild indeed. It just used to manifest itself on this level of trust there, that he could be fooled on an extended comm line. He could trust untrustworthy people. He'd do it time and time again. All of our staff members knew it. It wasn't just Anne and I had noticed it. We all knew it. We'd all been the effect of it, and we used to talk about it. It was quite obvious. It was blatantly obvious that he would believe in theta at a distance. And there was nothing you could do about it. Later, towards 1954-55, the paranoia became more marked. And it was quite obvious then that, I remember the arguments I had with Ron in his office on the subject of when he was saying about the psychiatrists. And I would submit my advice to him. I remember I was a senior executive in the org and I knew the man personally. And so I felt I could speak to him. I'd say, "Ron, just leave the psychiatrist alone. Don't bother them. If we don't bother them, they won't bother us." And he'd say, "No, Dennis," he'd say, "there's things happening on our comm lines. Those damn psychiatrists are out to get us. They're upsetting our comm lines. So we've got to get them first." And I say, I used to bite my tongue. I couldn't go too far. I mean, after all, he was the managing director. But as polite as possible, I'd say, "Ron, there's nothing there. They're not doing anything. If we leave them alone, we've got the tech. All we've got to do is apply our tech, and we'll win. We don't need to start going into game conditions and playing games and opposing the psychiatrist." But no, he wouldn't have it. He wouldn't have a bar of it. That was the beginnings of his paranoia. Now, paranoia is a mental state where a person believes that the world is against him. He has a lowered level of trust. There's a gradient scale of paranoia which goes from just this tiny lowered level of trust that a person has difficulty trusting at a distance. Then it gets they have difficulty trusting close up. Then they begin to feel that the whole world is against them. and coupled with it is that self is always right. Self is right and the world is against me. They are the characteristics of paranoia. And during the latter part of his life, Ron, there's no doubt, was markedly paranoic. Many of his activities there quite proved it. That it was a definite mental condition he had that was worsening as his life went on, which is quite typical. It's well known that paranoia is a mental condition that worsens as a person grows older. And it certainly worsened in Ron's life. His paranoia worsened. And eventually it worsened as the tragic events in the latter years of his life, when we hear of the events that happened in the Sea Org and so on. But I'm jumping the gun on my story. But eventually it almost led to the decline of the collapse of Scientology. And it certainly resulted in his paranoia was a direct cause of Scientology organizations, the church falling into the hands of these unscrupulous people that it's evidently fallen into today. And that is a direct result of Ron's increasing paranoia in his latter years. But as I say, I'm jumping the gun here. But if you really want to understand the latter years of Ron Hubbard's life, you'd better bone up on the subject of paranoia in any psychiatric textbook. And it's a well-documented mental condition. And you'll find that Ron suffered from it. He sure suffered from it in his latter years. But in his early, when I first knew him in the early mid-1950s, 52, 53, it wasn't evident there. The man was free of it. It was only in the later years, till 54, 55, he began to show it there, began to get this difficulty handling comm lines at a distance, and trust started to show up, and so on. It slowly worsened during his life. Did I notice any difference in the personality of Ron between 1956, when the last time I saw him, and 1962, when I saw him again on the St. Hill briefing course, and spoke to him again at St. Hill? Yes, there was a definite change in the personality. He was a lot heavier and a lot physically a lot older, and he looked much, much worse physically, not just because he was grosser, his body was fatter, but I would say that he was, during that period when I was at St. Hill, that he was under enormous, I'm speaking now as an auditor, as a Scientologist, I would say that he was under enormous psychological re-stimulation, enormous re-stimulation of his bank during the time. I knew it then, but I didn't know why he was under such heavy re-stimulation. And it was only later that I realised that his research on goals that he was doing in 1962 was killing him. And it was only when I started to do my own research in the area of goals and purposes in conflict that I realised the pitfalls that Ron had fallen into and how dangerous these pitfalls are, because they nearly killed me too as I tried to work through these pitfalls. And fortunately, I solved it. I got it out, but Ron never did solve it, and he suffered. He suffered cruelly from his bank in the 1960s, and I don't think psychologically he ever recovered from that, because he never did get it right. If he'd have solved the problem of postulates in conflict, his bank would have gone out of his stem. He would have got it right, and all of it would have vanished off of his mind. He would have been clear of it. He would have been free of it. But he never solved it technically. And because he never solved it technically, he never got out of re-stimulation. And that re-stimulation of his bank stayed with him for the rest of his life, right until the very end. In fact, his psychological condition worsened considerably from around about 1962 onwards. If you track the man's life there, you'll see it went fairly smoothly through the 50s and there's a slight paranoia. And then from about 1961, late 61, 62, he started to get under heavy re-stimulation when he got into the subject of goals. And then he really started, his paranoia got worse, as you would expect it to do. And by the mid-60s and so forth, he was almost, well, the people who were with him at that time were saying that he was almost impossible to communicate with, that he was always right, he had to be right, and he trusted no one, and he was firmly convinced that everyone was out to steal Scientology. In other words, the paranoia was marked. He was doing all sorts of things to try and save the organisations, which weren't being attacked by anyone, but he believed they were under constant attack. They weren't. And he brought in a set of ethics policies. Well, you can get the whole picture. If you know if you follow the cycle there, you'll see the decline of the personality of the great man that he was. I think I met him when I first met him in 1952. He was at his peak as a person. I can't say that for sure, because I didn't know him. I'd never met him prior to 1962. But I would say offhand that he was at his peak when he ran about late 1952, when he just discovered Scientology and he got into exteriorization. And he himself was a good theta exterior, good theta clear he was, personally he was. And this was the high point of his life. The output of his technical output during that period was absolutely incredible, was quite phenomenal, his technical output during the 50s. And he was very, very high-toned, very high-toned. So I'd say that he reached his peak at that period. I was fortunate I knew the man during his peak. And it was only towards the end, towards the 1950s, late 1955, 56, that we started to see, I started to become aware of the decline, which was even more marked in 1962. I was appalled by what I saw in 1962. I really felt for Ron, but I didn't know what was happening. I knew he was under re-stim, but I didn't know why he was under such cruel re-stimulation. He thought he was solving it. He really did. He thought he was solving the subject. And we all thought he was solving the subject of prostitutes in conflict goals. He used to talk so highly about his technology. We all thought that he'd solved it. He thought he'd solved it, but he hadn't. It was killing him. It was killing everyone who tried it. That was the awful thing about it. It's the thing about goals technology. Once you play with goals and put them into conflict, you're in conflict with each other. You either do it exactly right or you kill the preclear. And that is a technical datum. You better do it right or you're going to kill someone. And in TROM, I know how to do it right. But it's the only technology I know that will do it right. I don't know of any other technology that does it right. And certainly Ron's technology on goals did not do it right. And he was killing himself. And I don't know anyone who got any benefit from it. And he was killing others too. Another facet of Ron's personality that very few people know about is that he had considerable sexual difficulties. I first became aware of this on the HBA course in 1952. He gave a lecture on the subject of sex. And it was the first time I ever, in the whole time I ever knew Ron Hubbard for many years, and I must have sat through hundreds of his lectures when he gave live. It was the only time I ever saw him uncomfortable physically when he spoke. It was the only time he ever spoke about sex. He spoke about sex once on the HBA course. He devoted a whole hour's lecture to the subject of sex. And it hit him really hard. He was very, very uncomfortable speaking about it. And it was only in retrospect when I look back at it that I realised that, and other things I data I heard, so forth, things I heard about him, I realised that he had more than average difficulties on the subject of sex as a person, as a part of his personality. I won't go into details as to what they are because I'm not absolutely certain. I didn't know him that well, but I would say that he had considerable sexual difficulties as a person. And he was not comfortable with the subject of sex. Sex was an uncomfortable subject for Ron Hubbard. You'll notice that we're interested that such an important subject of sex, it's a very important subject to human beings, yet there's hardly any mention of sex in the whole technology of Scientology. There's hardly any mention of it. Ron did not study sex. He didn't. He doesn't appear. It hardly appears. There's just a few throwaway lines in one or two of his tapes, one or two of his lectures, and it's mentioned in one or two of his books and so forth. But the subject of sex did not receive the attention it deserved in Scientology. It was almost totally neglected. I have filled up these gaps when I've studied Trom, when I'm doing the research on Trom. I've filled in the gaps that Ron was too uncomfortable for Ron to research the area of sexuality. Well, it's not uncomfortable for me to research the area of sexuality because I don't have any bugs on the subject. So it's an easy one for me to research. And I've researched it and got all the bugs out of the subject. But poor old Ron. It was too tough for him. That's why he kept away from it. And that's why you won't find anything on the subject of sex in any of his books and writings and tapes. It's almost... That in itself is odd, isn't it? If you think about it. It's only because of his own peculiarities on the subject of sex. He had sexual problems. And he was very uncomfortable on the subject of sex, Ron was. It was not a comfortable subject with Ron Hubbard, with sex. It was no surprise to me when I discovered that the atrocious way he treated one of his sons when he discovered that one of his sons was homosexual. He virtually threw the lad out of his life and that he virtually misowned him. And only a person with considerable difficulties on the subject of sex could do that to his own son. Ron would have to have lots of difficulties on the subject of sex, and he did have lots of difficulties, and only a person like that could do that to his own son, who happened to be born a homosexual. And so all the bits over the years, if you put the bits together, they all sort of fit. They all fit together. And he never did get these things resolved, his sex life resolved in therapy. He never did get them resolved. They stayed with him to the day he died. He never did get them. I don't think he ever had the courage to mention them to an auditor, because he simply didn't trust auditors to audit him. Maybe in his latter years with David Mayo he might have done. I don't know what sort of relationship they had, but I don't think so. I would be very surprised if they did anything but work on various OT techniques and so forth. I'd be very surprised if David Mayo dug out an e-meter and said, right, Ron, today we're going to talk about sex. All right, here we go. No, the sessions would have been run by Ron. Ron always ran the sessions when he was ordered to operate. That was my experience with Ron, that he was always running the session. One of the more interesting offshoots of Ron Hubbard's paranoia was that during his lifetime, from the 1950 onwards, right through to 1980 when he died, he had a selection of the world's greatest Dianeticists and Scientologists working for his organisation. They all, sometime or another, worked in his organisation, and without exception, he let each and every one of them slip through his fingers. He lost the lot. Now, that is quite an achievement. He had the pick of the crop. He had the best. And he lost the lot. Each and every one of them, almost without exception, he had an ARC break. We went through a cycle that he welcomed them in. He had ARC, and then the relationship soured. There was an ARC break, and he threw them out. And he let them go, he let them slip through his fingers. Maybe he brought them back afterwards. Some people went back with some in and out of the organisation many times. Some great Scientologists worked for Ron on and off for many times. But inevitably, in the end, they parted company. They realised the difficulty, it was impossible to work with the men, and they didn't have to. They were good enough in their own right. They didn't have to work with him. They didn't have to be under this constant emotional strain of his peculiar neuroses and psychoses. They didn't have to suffer it. So they used to get out of the org. So he let them all slip through his fingers. Now that is quite an achievement. If he'd have been a different personality than the man he was, he could have collected over the years, he could have made darn sure that he collected all the greatest Scientologists that ever passed through the training colleges and training schools And we did, and some of them were brilliant. He could have collected the lot, made darn sure that they all of them ended up in his organisations over the planet. And he would have had the, he would have had a staff then of the cream of the cream, and he could have done it because he knew how to evaluate them. But he couldn't. His paranoia beat him every time. He always ended up letting them slip through his fingers. Sometimes he believed lies about them and fired them on lies. You know, he believed lies that they'd done things that they hadn't done. Other times he was simply jealous of them. Some of the greatest Scientologists who worked for Ron got fired because they were simply too good. He was scared that they were going to take over his glory. And so he fired them out of sheer pique. That again was a part of his paranoia. We see that he had to be the only one. Nobody could take the mantle. It had to be him, you see. And so, of course, when you approach an organisation with that idea, there comes a time when you're going to die, and who are you going to hand it over to? You see, you haven't trained a successor. You haven't made any provisions for the succession of the organisation. So that's what happened to the Scientology organisations. When Ron died, it fell into the hands of incompetent adolescents, or young people in their mid-20s, who knew very little of life. Many of them had spent the whole of their life since childhood in the Sea Org, had no idea of life. They worked their way up through the Sea Org. All they knew was Scientology policies, and suddenly they were senior executives, and they were now in charge of this wild worldwide organisation. Well, they had no claims to these positions, no claims at all. They simply hadn't got the technical expertise or ability to hold down these positions that they were in. And so, of course, the subject suffered. And that's why we find in the organisation of Scientology today is in the parlous state that it is in. It's simply in the hands of incompetent children. So we see how the personality of Ron governed the future of his own organisation, quite inevitably. But we can see quite clearly the outcome. The situation today was brought about entirely by the nature and the actions of one L. Ron Hubbard, the founder of Dianetics and Scientology. Finally, and at this late stage in my life, I can assure you that I don't view Ron Hubbard in 1994. I'm not the same person I was as the person who viewed him in September 1952. I can assure you that I'm quite a different person. So the stars are no longer in my eyes, but I think I can view the man much more objectively now than I could then. What is my final summation and assessment? Well, as a therapist, as a psychotherapist, philosopher, and so forth, he was second to none, and was undoubtedly the greatest man of his field of this century. There is absolutely no doubt about that. That his researches and his additions to the sum total of human knowledge of the human psyche, well, he added more than all the rest ever did. You know, he added more than all the rest ever did put together. When you think of the miserable things that the psychiatrist and the miserable discoveries that the psychologist and the psychiatrist come up with in their universities, when they've got all these vast funds to play with. And Ron self-financed his own research and comes up with enormously workable technology. It's the difference between plodders and a genius. The man was, in his field, was a genius. There's no doubt about that. He was a genius. He was a flawed genius. But a man could be excused for being a flawed genius. We're very, very fortunate to have had Ron. Very, very fortunate. People don't know how fortunate we were to have Ron Hubbard. And one of the saddest things that's happening on this planet at this time is that his work is, as far as I know, and I have this on quite reliable authority, that his work is being plundered and altered and not is by his own church that he's left it to. The people there are methodically going through his works and changing his works and changing it, chopping it up and throwing out the bits that they don't think are any good. And it's being changed by these incompetent juveniles. It's like leaving a vast mass of workable technology to a group of children who don't understand it and who play with it, and yet because it doesn't happen to fit the whims of their of what they think the way it ought to be, they change it to make it fit the whims of their silly rather pathetic little minds. That's what's happening to Scientology today on this planet. The repository of the Scientology tech is being plundered by the people, by the keepers of the repository. The keepers of the archives are in there with the scissors, chopping up the material. Oh yes, they hold him in great reverence as they chop up his material and make it more marketable. Their excuse for doing it is to make it more marketable, to make it more profitable, because that is their only goal, is to profit. But this isn't a talk about profit. This isn't a talk about marketing. This isn't a talk about business. This is a talk about the Ron Hubbard, the man. Yes, as I say, we were very, very fortunate. Most of the planet don't know how fortunate we were to have Ron during that period from 1911 to 1983. And we certainly, the vast majority of mankind, didn't appreciate his genius. Sure, he was a flawed genius. Most geniuses are, you know. The last perfect genius, well, the last perfect genius, if I remember rightly, I think they nailed him up on a cross. So I think Ron could be excused for being a flawed genius. During the 1950s, when I believe Ron was at his best as a research Scientologist, some of his material was breathtaking in its simplicity and breathtaking in its application. I mean, Ron called me in the mid-50s. I was on record as being the encyclopedia of Scientology. He used to call me an encyclopedia of Scientology because he could use me as a reference. If he wanted quickly to know something, he just called me in and said, "Dennis, what about so-and-so?" I'll say, "Oh, yes, page number so-and-so." You know, I was a reference. I was an encyclopedia of Scientology. But he just used to leave me breathless at times, you know. He'd come in, say, into the August, say, 10 o'clock in the morning, and got the students, say, I was DOT at the time, and the tape would be running, and I'd hear him come in, and there'd be a tap on the door, and I'd recognise the tap, and off I'd trot off to his office, or he'd call in the secretary, and the girl would come in and get me, and say, "Ron wants you." And he'd come through and he'd have something written on a piece of paper. He'd say, "What do you think of this?" And he'd explain what the problem was. And I said, I'd just be aghast. I said, "Ron, it's incredible." "Yes," he'd say, "it is good, isn't it?" And he'd give me a little talk on the subject. You know, he thought of it on the bus coming down that morning. The sheer fertility of the man's creativity at that period was absolutely incredible. There, it was, you know, a good 95% of the material never saw the light of day. It got superseded and so forth, and some of it was absolutely first class stuff, and many of it got lost on desert air. Well, I've forgotten it, but it was all good stuff. It was brilliant stuff. He was a creative genius. There was no doubt about that. That he should have had somebody walking around behind him with a tape recorder and catching every word, putting it down for posterity. He was that sort of man during the brilliant part of his life. Unfortunately, it didn't maintain. The quality of his lectures during 1962 on the briefing course were far less than they were in the 1950s. Some of them were just downright boring. He used to try and make them interesting. But of course, again, he was under enormous re-stimulation, which he wasn't under in the 1950s. So again, he's excusable. So, but nevertheless, the material there I think the creative spark was already going in 1962. Was already fading out. But it's difficult to be certain of it because of the enormous re-stimulation he put himself under. And he would, well, not that he'd done it consciously, but the enormous re-stimulation that he was under on the subject of purposes in conflict. I know one of the great sadnesses in his life at that time was that he couldn't communicate this material to Mary Sue. Mary Sue was never, although she was publicised as being a technical expert, she never was, you know. She was definitely second, third rate on her grasp of Scientology tech, and she couldn't stay with Ron. She couldn't even, half the time, she couldn't even follow what he was talking about, you know. And so at home, when he used to try and talk to Mary Sue about these things, it was talking to a brick wall. That's why he used to love coming down to the Org and talking to guys like Jack Parkhouse and Ray Kemp and me and so forth, and all to Anne. You know, he used to love talking to his tech staff because we listened to him and could comment intelligently. His wife couldn't, Mary Sue couldn't. Although Ron used to burn the midnight oil trying to make Mary Sue into a technical expert, that she just hadn't got it in her. She was very good at raising babies, Mary Sue was, but as a technical wizard in Scientology, she simply wasn't. Well, there isn't much more I can think of on the subject of Ron Hubbard the man. I think I've just about exhausted the lot, and I'm very, very glad to have met him. I consider it a great privilege. It's one of the great privileges in my life to have been able to work with Ron Hubbard, and to have some of his greatness brush off on me, as I think some of it did. Well, that just about wraps it up, Anthony. And I hope you'll be able to transcribe this tape, and you may be able to even get an article out of it. I don't know. Anyway, I'll pass it over to you, and all the best. Ta-da for now.